Maybe I will in the process.
Okay, it's May 24th, 2006, and I'm David Brooks. I'm the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project, and I'm interviewing Merrill Club. And Mr. Club, I guess I'd like you to start out by just giving us a little bit of your personal history and your educational background and what brought you to Missoula and the University of Montana.
Well, I don't know where to begin my personal history, but I was born in New Haven, Connecticut, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. But I grew up primarily, I guess, in Texas, where I went to grade school, at least from the third grade on, and then through high school. And then my father was a professor of English, and he went to TCU, Texas Christian University. I don't remember the exact date. And that's where I grew up in Texas. And then I went through grade school there. About the time I was supposed to go to college, we of course didn't have any money. We coming out of the depression, and my father was working at one point for $1,500 a year, which isn't very much for a family of four. And or five, I guess the family was, because I had two brothers. But he would, of course, like to have me go to Yale, because that's where he got his PhD. And there's no way I was going to go to Yale. It was expensive, too far too expensive. And so he was moving to Oklahoma A&M as chairman, they called it head of the department there, of English. And so I just went along and went to school. And the university there had a surprisingly good liberal arts program, and with teachers from major, is still close to the depression, so that there were teachers from major institutions, California and Chicago, Yale, Harvard, the works. And so I got a fairly good education there, although I discovered I didn't get much of one when I went to Yale eventually. I guess I was in Oklahoma when the war broke out, World War II, and the bombing of Pearl Harbor and so on. And all of my friends, both instructors and student friends, were joining up gradually, so that I came to be about the last person left there. My father was fairly something of a pacifist by that time, although he'd been gung-ho to get into World War I. But his eyes kept him out. And but at any rate, I'd joined the Navy and went to war and came back from that. And with nothing else to do, I went back to Oklahoma A&M and took a couple of courses in the summer of 1946. Then my father, found a job at University of Kansas as chairman of the department there. So I just went along with him and intending to enroll in a few courses to pass the time till I could figure out what to do with myself. And because I had no great yearning to get into the academic world. And when I went to enroll in graduate school, the dean, who was a professor of English and a new graduate dean, simply assumed that the son of a chairman of the department ought to be able to teach English. He asked me if I wanted to teach, and I said, well, I guess so. And he said, one course or full time. I was, well, okay, full time. So I taught at the University of Kansas for 2 years. And I was very fortunate because they required I think it was called an Iowa system or something like that, but every student in the university had to take four courses in English. The first one was composition, and the rest of them were literature courses. So I taught a full range of literature courses, world literature courses, in effect, in addition to the composition course for 2 years. And then I decided, well, I might as well keep on going. And there were about three of us who were instructors there, went to Yale for graduate school. And I was accepted, I suspect, primarily because of my father. And so I went there for 1 year. And it was, of course, a top-flight school. And I got along okay, but I had to work like the very devil to do it. And eventually, at the end of the year, I had in the meantime met one of my students back in Kansas. And we got married in 1949, and so I wanted to take some time out. I got a job at the University of Oregon, and I taught there for a couple of years. And there again, I was fortunate because I was hired just simply to teach composition, period, four courses, and that was it. But the chairman kind of liked me, I guess, and so the second year, he let me teach a course in Survey of English Literature, which meant from Beowulf to Thomas Hardy. That's as far as you went in those days. And so I used that quite consciously as a means of preparing for comprehensives, and went and then decided to go to Michigan instead of going back to Yale to get the PhD. Primarily because they only required two languages, and Yale required three. I remember when I went to Yale, about this first week that we were there, we went into a room and some man, professor, handed out three pieces of paper and said, "Translate them." One was French, one was German, one was Latin. And I managed to struggle through the French one the first time. And later on, I passed the German, but I should have been able to pass Latin because I had about 6 years of it in high school, but it didn't do any good. And it's medieval Latin, too, although that's much easier than classical Latin. But at any rate, I didn't want to fool with that, so Michigan only required two courses, and they accepted the ones that I passed at Yale. So I went to Yale and ended up in medieval literature and got a PhD. And I was fortunate because my wife she was able to teach. She taught grade school. And so I was able to go full-time to school, and I got my PhD in 2 years, which is much faster than most people did. They usually took 4, 5, 6 years. And I remember one time that I was there. There was a group of us. We were having lunch or something rather. And I was sort of speaking in a bravado kind of way. And I said, "Oh, I can pass that exam anytime." And this other guy said, "Well, why don't you do it?" And so I did. And I passed. They had preliminary exams to get you into it. And so I was able to start work on my dissertation the second year and finish it. But at any rate, from there I went to University of Houston, and they were just beginning to build up, and I was one of the fair-haired young men coming. There were about five of us came, but all five of us took one look at it and started looking elsewhere. And it was just impossible at the time. It was still essentially a high school, basically, although a man named Cullen had built a nice campus. And I had good course set up. I was teaching history of the language, and I think I was teaching a medieval literature course if I wanted to. And I guess they were grooming me to be chairman, but I had no idea. The man who was there was a former instructor of mine, and I really wasn't about to get in his hair. So I started writing scattershot to the Northwest because I had liked the country around Oregon, and I wanted to come to the Northwest, and I liked the Rainy Mountains and that sort of thing compared to the Southwest Mountains where I had grown up with my father. And so it turned out that there was an opening here in Montana. Oregon wouldn't take me because I'd been there, and they had a policy of not bringing back people that had been there. And of course, Washington was pretty much out of the question at the time. But anyhow, the job opened here. I think H.G. Merriam had been chairman for about 30 years at that point. And I don't know what happened, but he sort of quit in the middle, or retired in the middle of the year, which opened up the job. And what's his name? Freeman was, Edmund Freeman was acting as chairman, and he looked at my credentials and hired me with no interview or anything of the kind. And I knew nothing about Montana. It was just a name to me. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I started looking up and asking questions, so on. And the only thing that came up was Leslie Fiedler, whose name was well known at the time. Mm-hmm. And so that was encouraging. So at any rate, I arrived with Jake Vinegar, who was a young instructor here. I guess we were assistant professors. And
what year was that you arrived?
That was 1954. So mm-hmm. I've been here since 1954. I've had opportunities and I've had job interviews, but I like the country. Mm-hmm. And one interview was a much better job in some respects in the University of Toledo, and I figured that, well, all I'll do is spend my money, the extra money coming back out here mm-hmm. for vacation, so why not stay? And so I stayed, which had less money.
So, coming from experiences at Oklahoma A&M, University of Kansas, Yale, University of Oregon, University of Michigan, and then University of Houston. Quite a variety of universities mm-hmm. there, from the small, just developing University at Houston to Yale. Your experiences both as student and as a teacher at all those. Talk a little bit about your impressions of the University of Montana when you arrived here.
Well, it too was a surprisingly good school, I thought. And the department was good. It was a very stimulating department. There were good people in it. Leslie Fiedler was, of course, the core of it, in a way. And his presence made it interesting, very interesting. And other members of the faculty were good, and I really enjoyed being with them. And one day Leslie came to me and showed me a form for a Fulbright grant, and it was for a linguist, somebody who had some ability in teaching English as a foreign language. And I said, well, I'm no linguist. He said, well, be one. So I decided I was one. Mm-hmm. And I applied for it. It was at Cairo. And my father had been there that year, the year before, and so I knew something about Cairo, mm-hmm. and it sounded pretty good. And so I was accepted, and the nominal, what do you call it, thesis advisor at Michigan was Albert Marquardt, who was a very well-known linguist, and he somehow or other was involved in getting me the Fulbright grant. And so he told me that I should come to Michigan and go to the Linguistic Institute that summer before I went, and that was sort of a prerequisite for getting the grant. So we went there, and I spent the summer. It was very interesting because I took a number of good courses from first-rate people in linguistics mainly, well, entirely. And of course, I'd had a number of courses at Yale and at Michigan before that involved linguistics in effect. I mean, the history of the English language and Old English and Middle English dialects and things of that sort. And so I took a course in teaching a foreign language from Charles, I think it was, was it from Charles Freeze? No, it was from somebody else. But at any rate, I got an introduction to Chomsky's work at that time. And I also, there was a man who was right back from Cairo, and he had brought, he was a professor at Rutgers or someplace back there, and he brought in, brought to the Institute three Arabs from Cairo, and he was teaching a course in the analysis of Arabic, and so we spent most of the summer just asking him questions, eventually arriving at a pretty good picture of the phonology of Arabic, mm. and also to a certain extent the grammar of Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
Some syntax, but not too much. And so that was a very good experience, interviewing these three informants and learning how to analyze a totally different language, a non-Indo-European language. And so I had a pretty fair notion of what, how Arabic, at least the Arabic of Cairo, was put together. So we headed out for Cairo, and about the time the Suez business blew up in 1956, and we were told to stop in Rome, which we did. And so for the first month, we did nothing but stay in a, we stayed in a pensione in Rome. We did nothing but toured the city, taking turns. We had two children at the time, and two and a half, and whatever the other one was, a year younger.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really did did a good job on Rome. Then they told us to stay, and we went to Perugia and started studying Italian and that sort of thing. Then ended up in Naples for a year. And I did quite a lot of traveling. My job involved it, although I did teach at a Istituto Universitario Orientale, and it was kind of strange teaching because the professors there just would come and go, and the students would come and go, and you couldn't count on anything. I like to prepare lectures in a long series, looking ahead, and but I never knew who was going to be in my class the next day, and that I didn't like that very mm-hmm. much. I was giving a course in the application of linguistics to teaching English as a foreign language, and so anyhow. Where was I?
In Naples. No, in Perugia.
In Perugia?
Perugia.
Perugia. Learning Italian. And,
mm-hmm.
and anyhow, we ended up at Naples, and I did a lot of traveling where I conducted seminars and things like that for Italian teachers of English. We were training teachers, the Italians teach English as a mm-hmm. foreign language. And the second year, we moved to Rome, and I was attached to the University of Rome, although I never did see it. And we lived out of Ostia, though, because it was a lot cheaper. And while we were there, I also did a lot of traveling. I went to Venice and stayed there for a couple of years. Went to Trieste for a couple, not a couple of years, a couple of weeks. Trieste for a couple of weeks, and Sardinia for a month. And then we held month-long seminars in the summer. It was really great in many ways. And my wife had had to stay home with the two children most of the time. And she had a very interesting experience because she got in to know the peasantry quite well. She got to know our babysitter and cook, who was just a peasant Italian. She thought Mussolini was a great man. He made the trains run on time. And she still longed for him. And so, and then she would take my wife out to the little villages and so forth, and they would involve, just enjoy festivals and just have a big time. And I remember one time we went to Paris. My wife and I went to Paris and left the two kids with Antoinette. And the little girl, my little girl, wasn't talking when we left. And we came back and she was just chattering away in Italian. And it was kind of funny. And the second year there at Rome, there's a big shot from Cornell, Robert A. Hall Jr., who's a very good French linguist, Romance linguist. And he prided himself on his Italian. And he came in and, well, I'm changing the subject a little bit, but my son also had learned English and Romanesco. And I remember that Bob Hall started talking to him in Italian. My son refused to talk to him because he knew he wasn't a native speaker of Italian. Hmm. And it was kind of funny the way he reacted. He knew he talked to Italians in Italian very easily, very fluently. But Hall was good in Italian, but he wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. And I could tell that myself. So at any rate, that was kind of an interesting experience. And we got to see a lot of it. I got to see a lot of it in Italy, all over, quite literally. And we traveled around Sicily on our way out and went encircled the island. I had a brand new Fiat for that purpose, so I was going to take it home with me. And we managed to get up to France and Germany and Munich and London, met my brother who had married he had a PhD from Yale too, and he had married an English girl. So we visited them in London, which was, of course, nice. And so all in all, that was a very interesting 2 years, much better than it would have been mm-hmm. in Cairo, I suspect.
And did you come back to the University of Montana?
And then came back to the University of
Montana. So your job was here.
So because my job was mm-hmm. here, and I came back here. So I taught 2 more years, and then another Fulbright opportunity opened up at in Syria, Damascus. So I was accepted for that, and I was all set to go to Damascus, and I was beginning to read about Arabic history and all that sort of thing, Muslims and so on. And then that fell through. They decided they didn't want any Fulbright people, and I already had a leave of absence. So the people in Washington, in the Fulbright office in the State Department, offered me a job in Burma. So we went to Burma and lived there for, we were there before the military government took over, which was great because the Burmese people are just wonderful people, very similar to Italians in some respects in their attitudes toward life. That is ordinary people. And we enjoyed that. We had 5 servants there. You can't beat that. And they refused, that was kind of interesting, they refused to talk Burmese to us. I ordered them. I ordered Mao Mien to speak Burmese, and he just flat wouldn't do it. They just insisted on talking English. Hmm. And the same thing was true in the bazaars. You couldn't talk Burmese. You try. They all insisted on talking English. So we didn't get much chance to learn to talk Burmese. Mm-hmm. I studied Burmese and learned how it was organized and put together and all that sort of thing, the phonology and the grammar. But, and I learned phrases, of course. And I managed to travel around Burma quite a bit. I went up all the way to Bamo, which is pretty close to the Chinese border. And then we took a trip, another Fulbright and a grantee and I took a trip down the Irrawaddy all the way to Mandalay, and I got dysentery on the way down. I couldn't stand drinking beer all the way and tea all the way. Mm-hmm. I had to drink water somewhere, and I took one swig of water, and that was it, bacillary dysentery. Mm-hmm. An Indian doctor told me in Mandalay, and of course I got over it, but at any rate, the military coup took place along about March, I guess it was. General Ne Win was the one who led it and took over Burma. And he kicked everybody out. I was going to stay another year. I already had another Fulbright grant, but I also wanted a job with the Asia Foundation because they would have given me a Mercedes Benz. And that's what I wanted to have with a chauffeur. And so at any rate, I was all set to stay another year in Burma, one way or another. And I'd given up my job here for the time, for that year. And when the military coup took over, they kicked everybody out. They kicked out all of the Americans and the British mostly, I guess except for the British Council. They kicked the Russians out. They kicked everybody. The Israelis, they kicked them out, so on. And so I was footloose and fancy free, and I thought I was going to go to Saigon. My wife tells me it was Da Nang, which is where the Marines landed eventually, I guess a year or so later. And so I was planning to go there, but I wanted to get home, and so I came here for the summer, and discovered later I couldn't go back. They wouldn't pay my way. They'd pay my way, but they wouldn't pay the way my family's way back. Well, I couldn't pay their way back to Vietnam, and so I said, no way. But so then they offered me a job in Colombia, in Bogota, so I went there. By that time we had four kids. Well, we had four kids in Burma, of mm-hmm. course. We systematically went around the world when that trip took place. Stopped at Kathmandu and, Calcutta, Kathmandu, New Delhi, and Agra, and then went to Kabul. I'd been offered a job there, and I wanted to see what it looked like, and I took one look at that, and that was enough. Because all of the Americans lived in a compound with a wall around them. All of the British lived in a compound with a wall around them, and similarly the Russians. And while the Afghans were very, very wonderful people, and you could ask them to your house. You could ask them to your house, and they would go, but then they'd be picked up on the way out by the government. So I just couldn't see staying in a foreign country when I couldn't mingle with the people. And so that's when I was offered the job at Columbia. And
what was the job there?
Same thing. I was running an English language program mm-hmm. down there. And down there, I also was assigned the job of supervising the first contingent of Peace Corps people who came down. Mm. And so my job was to go all around Columbia to the universities and prepare them for the coming of these Peace Corps mm-hmm. people. And my Spanish, I could make my way around in Italian okay. And I was beginning to learn Spanish, but I went around trying to talk to these people in Spanish, and it was just hilarious. I remember I went to the University of Cartagena and talked to the an assistant to the president or something of the sort. And I struggled and struggled trying to tell him about all these Peace Corps people coming in. And after about an hour, he started talking to me in fluent English. He was being too polite.
Right. So obviously the university was in support of you traveling and taking these
they seemed to be, although I remember in Columbia that Leslie Fiedler was chairman by that mm-hmm. time. My first job here was to elect him chairman, mm-hmm. which is a little strange because I didn't know anybody in the department.
And that's after you got back from these Fulbrights?
No, this was when I arrived there the first time,
He handed you the Fulbright application.
Yeah. And he was chairman at the time. Mm-hmm. And he wrote me a letter, a rather plaintive letter, saying that, who are you? Mm-hmm. And which was saying, come on back, just let us know who you are.
Right.
Because I'd been gone. I'd been here 2 years, then away 2 years, then back 2 years, mm-hmm. then away 2 years. Mm-hmm. But we were fortunate because we were traveling pre-Americanization of the world. So we saw it in what you might call its original virgin state, mm-hmm. all of these places. I remember the first supermarket coming into Rome, Supermercato, I guess it was. And so at any rate, we'd sort of had our fill of traveling by that point and never have done much of it since.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you both thought that the University of Montana was a good place for you, and they must have thought you were a good candidate for them, allowing you to go and come and go and come like that. And you did mention that when you first got here, you could tell this was a good department.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've mentioned Leslie Fiedler. How about a little more about the department itself at the time when you were first here? The curriculum, students, what attracted you? What made you feel like this is a good place?
Well, the students were good, and mm-hmm. I guess we were teaching three courses. Most of us were teaching, well, I guess almost all of us were teaching three courses at the time. And I had an opportunity to teach whatever I wanted to. I taught history of the language, and I taught medieval literature, and I organized an entire year course in medieval literature over three quarters. We were on the quarter system then, and that was good. And the people were stimulating to me. Walter Van Tilburg Clark was here. He's a good writer at the time. Nelson Algren came for a time, and with Leslie here, he sort of attracted a lot of good people or visitors, so that Auden was here, William Auden was here for a few days or a week, whatever. William Faulkner came, and Faulkner was interesting, for he gave a public lecture, which my wife won't like my saying this, but it was a miserable lecture. It was just given in a monotone and uninteresting, and he didn't say anything. But he came to a party at the Fiedlers afterwards, and it was quite a nice gathering, and people talked back and forth, and he talked, and he opened up quite a bit. And somebody asked him to read, and so he read, and it was just the most marvelous thing I ever heard at the time. Mm-hmm. It was really something startling to listen to him read from mm-hmm. his own works.
And Leslie Fiedler was one of the main draws to bring people like that.
He was one of the main draws mm-hmm. for people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, it was a lively department, and people seemed to enjoy each other. They had parties together, and they interrelated and mm-hmm. so forth.
And how about relationships with students at the time?
And with students, they had good relationships with mm-hmm. students, and I enjoyed teaching my courses, and I enjoyed the students that I had.
Where were you on campus when you first got here?
We were in, in the liberal arts building over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's over there.
Right, it still is.
Things changed considerably since I've retired. But anyhow, it was over there, and it was just plain pleasant to be here. And I had opportunities for other jobs, and I didn't want to take them.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up staying here, and it's a good place to bring up children. It was then, particularly. And they had good music for the kids, and we had four children, and they were all musical, and one of them played the violin quite well, another one played the bass, another one sang, and the first one played violin too for a long time. So that there was there was some kind of citywide grade school orchestra. I forget who ran it, but that's good. And mm-hmm. they all played in that orchestra. Then, of course, there was a high school orchestra, and they played in that. Three of them did. I guess my daughter turned out to be a singer and an actress. And of course, at a higher level, Gene Andre had the had started up the Civic Symphony, and ran that, and one of my sons took music lessons from violin lessons from him, and that was, of course, a great thing. For quite a number of years, he took with him.
How about extracurricular activities on campus here that you were involved in or aware of, or that students in your department participated in?
That I don't have much sense of, really. What I remember most is the interrelationship of the faculty, both in the department and outside the department. And after Leslie, well, I guess who's the president there? This is where my mind starts slipping. But at any rate,
before Panzer.
Oh, way before
McFarland.
Panzer. McFarland. Mm-hmm. McFarland was president when I arrived, and he was quite a man in his own way. He really ran things, and I remember that while I was gone, I guess he made Nan Carpenter, who was a professor. She was sort of crippled and by polio, and she had a degree from Yale, and she was, I guess, a good scholar, very good scholar, and a good teacher, I think, and she played the piano very well. And Leslie was chairman, and I guess he was supposed to be chairman for 3 years, and he wanted his third year, and he had received a professorship at Princeton, which he was going to take the place of Blackmer there, I think, that was it. And he wanted to go, and so we sort of all agreed that we would elect John Moore, who was a professor in the department, as chairman, which we did. And we went over to McFarland's office, and he always had a silver dollar, which he would use to tap attention and that sort of thing. And he had a great big judge's, he'd been a lawyer, and he had a great big judge's chair, which was a huge thing with a big back to it. And he'd sit there, and a very tremendous presence. And he just called the department in. It's fairly small then. And we would elect whoever the president would be, the chairman would be, and we elected John Moore because we'd agreed to do that, and Leslie was going to come back and take over, was the idea. Well, John Moore went off to Michigan, which he did every summer. He had a cabin up there, his family did. And while he was gone, McFarland just arbitrarily appointed Nan Carpenter chairman. Boom, like that. Without asking anybody anything. And she was a lousy chairman. And a lot of people didn't like her. The department was divided somewhat into two factions at that time.
Over?
The Fiedler faction and another faction.
Mm-hmm. And what was the other faction?
Well, Nan Carpenter was part of it. And
and what was the rift between the two?
I don't know. Well, mainly they didn't like Fiedler. And wanted him to go, I guess. I don't know whether it was jealousy or what, but he was hard to get along with in some ways, and very arrogant in some respects, and made no bones of what he thought about people, and he didn't think much of people like Nan Carpenter and Walter King and some of the others, and they were very sensitive to that. And they were both very good. Walter King and Nan Carpenter were both very good. I had known Walter King at Yale. We were very close friends there. And working when I was there for the MA, and he was starting too. And we used to swim together in the Yale swimming, the Yale pool to get exercise. And we sort of got together with other people and so on. But I got so sick and tired of him, I couldn't stand him. He was somewhat arrogant too, and he knew everything, which he did, compared to me anyway. And so we were sort of at odds just by the time I left. We ended up here. He came the year after I did. And I sort of suggested that he probably shouldn't, but I was overruled.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people that brought him were sorry because they didn't much like him. But anyhow, it was sort of split that way, mainly with a circle of Fiedler in one group. It was mm-hmm. the larger group and the better group, naturally. I was in that group, too.
Right, of course. So Carpenter takes over as the chairperson.
So she came over took over the job for a year or two, and then she was sort of booted out, and I forget what happened. I think we brought somebody in, and then another man named Vedder Gilbert was chairman for a long time too, and then we had two or three people coming in, and then eventually I became chairman. And so I was chairman for 17 years. I mm-hmm. took off, sort of went after, did the same thing that H.G. Merriam did in terms of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that job in a lot of ways. And it came along right at the right time. I was burned out in teaching, and I remember my head would ache coming up to school, having to teach three classes, and I just was burned out, and this came along, and it came at the right time.
Mm-hmm. And when did you begin as chair?
I can't remember. But if you could just take 17, 18 years back. Well, I guess I started the summer of 68.
Okay.
It was temporary at first. The idea was I would be temporary chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And then after, I guess, about the first year, they decided to make me a permanent chairman.
So it went from temporary to 17 years.
Yeah.
So you came in at a time that, you know, I've heard different people describe as quite volatile on the campus just because of Vietnam, as well as the growth of the student body and faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how those things played out in your department, or how you guided those things as the chairman, or if you would say those were even factors for you.
Well, Vietnam wasn't a factor for us in the department.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember that. I guess the 60s were supposed to be years of upheaval and so forth, but in the department I don't think we noticed it particularly. I felt that my job in the department was simply to try to make it possible for everybody in the department to work and to do their job, and that's what that seemed to me, the job of a chairman, really. Similarly, the job of a dean,
mm-hmm.
just make it easier for the faculty to work. And that's the way I looked at it, and that's the way I tried to run things and mm-hmm. do things. And, of course, in a democratic way, too. And But the only thing I remember about Vietnam, I became quite friendly with Bert Pfeiffer, who was somewhat notorious on the campus, too. We were very close friends, and we hunted together and fished together and that sort of thing. And then he was very active socially, I mean, in social ways and so forth. And he made two or three trips to Vietnam using his own money and during the war, and he was very much anti-Vietnam War. And he went to Hanoi one time, or maybe a couple times, I don't know, and ran into Jane Fonda and all that sort of thing, and he admired her a lot. But at any rate, during the Vietnam business, I do remember that the students were really up in arms too about I guess everybody throughout the country ultimately became up in arms, so to speak, against the war. And I remember that Bert Pfeiffer was leading the student groups, and they took over the gym over here. I think the big gym hadn't maybe whether it was built or not. I don't think so. I think this was it. Took over the ROTC, and it was quite a business. I wasn't really involved with that mm-hmm. because for some reason or other I was essentially apolitical, I guess, not apolitical most of my life. And during World War II, I know I was. I had no real awareness of what was going on. Had no real awareness of what was going on for years afterwards. And I can figure that out. It had to do with my relationships with my father and that sort of thing. And it was only after I retired that I became conscious of what was going on in the world. And
mm-hmm.
I've had to learn an awful lot since. But the department wasn't really much involved in mm-hmm. all of that.
How about relationships in the department between faculty and students? You mentioned when you first came it was pretty congenial and faculty got along, and you haven't mentioned the one division. But did as the department grew and as the school grew, did that stay?
Yeah, I think that at least all the time I was, the early part of the time, we saw our way, our function is to teach students mainly and to be interested in students, and we were. I think almost everyone was in one way or another. And so that it was a teaching faculty is what it was. And that's what I think that's the way we looked at ourselves mm-hmm. primarily. I mean, we believe that service was necessary, so-called, which is being on various kinds of committees and so forth, both departmental and university. And we also believed in research up to a point, but we weren't a research institution. We said, I didn't think so. And people weren't really forced to do research. They were expected to do some and to do some writing and so on. But I think mainly our main primary concern and primary pride was in the fact that we did a good job of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had good relations with the students, at least in while I was here, as far as I know, all along the line. And as you probably know, we had a very good creative writing program, which was nationally known even then. And actually, I think H.G. Merriam is the one who's responsible for starting it way back. And I think that has a long history. It may even have been written by now. And so we always had good people in that.
Mm-hmm. And how much did that affect or coincide with success of your department? Because certainly the creative writing department, there are plenty of nationally known names that have been through,
mm-hmm.
and people who taught as well. And so no doubt you would have been in contact with a lot of those writers who were teaching as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember Walter Van Tilburg Clark quite well, and I was quite friendly with him. I liked him a lot. I was sorry to see him go. And various other writers, I got along fine with them. Richard Hugo was, mm-hmm. was the big name for quite a long time.
And he came during your time as a chairman.
During my time as a chairman, I think.
Mm-hmm.
No, he must have come maybe a little bit before,
mm-hmm.
but pretty much about the same time. And I remember the first year he was here, he always liked kitchens, and he was in our kitchen for quite a long time. And I took a picture of him that appears on his first book. Didn't get any credit for it.
What was his attraction to kitchens?
I don't know, but he liked to sit in the kitchen, and that's where he would mm-hmm. gravitate to in whoever's house he was in.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very good poet, and he was interested in students, and of course he attracted students, and a very interesting man in a lot of ways. And then I guess Greg Pape is still here, isn't he? And he came just about the time I quit or mm-hmm. retired. I retired as chairman, that was in 1986, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm. And during the time you were both chairman as well as before, what kind of curricular changes took place in the department that either you were part of or at least saw happen? Over the emphases of the department as well as the interests of the students, I guess.
Well, I don't know that, I can't remember if there were any great changes at all. We had, I'm really not prepared to say, I can't remember too mm-hmm. well. The curriculum grew and well, that's about.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of, you know, clearly the English departments here as well as elsewhere teach modern literature, and so that is a way that departments have to continually keep up, so to say. And now this department here is somewhat known for regional literature and teaching regional literature, mm-hmm. and I wonder if any of those things were happening as you were.
Well, that was growing at the time, mm-hmm. and I guess what I did, and a lot of people, I guess I was criticized by some people for doing it, but I tended to let people teach what they felt they wanted to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody wanted to teach Montana literature, well, I'd let them make a course and do it. And Bill Beavis began, he came while we were here, while I was chairman, and he gravitated in that direction. And built up that, I think, quite a bit. And
in teaching regional or Montana literature?
Yeah, mm-hmm. teaching regional Montana literature. And but mainly, we do. I think, for the most part, at least as long as I was chairman, we tried to have a balanced program. And we were interested in, we had some good American literature people, we had some good British literature people, and we taught early. I taught medieval literature for a long time, and we tried to offer that regularly. And we offered history of the language fairly regularly. I taught that fairly regularly. I introduced linguistics, and then I brought in Bob Houseman, and he sort of really took the ball and really ran with it,
mm-hmm.
and developed a full department of it. Yes, and it's separate from the department now, but it used to be part of our department, and all the courses were part of our department. And I started most of them,
mm-hmm.
and then he came and began teaching in them.
And when did that become its own department?
That was after I left, I mm-hmm. think. That's what he was working in that direction at the time. And he was also interested in, I think, teaching English as a foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done quite a lot with that, I gather. But that's all since I was in the department. And now I guess he travels all over the place and goes to Japan and all kinds of places. And
when you first came, was the English department all undergrad students, or was there a graduate program?
No, we had a graduate program. Mm-hmm. We had an MA program.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a strong MA program.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we offered originally, I guess they had a degree in English with a creative writing interest, and eventually that broke off, and someone developed the idea of an MFA program and got that going.
Mm-hmm. And during your time here is when that
broke
off?
During my time, mm-hmm. uh-huh, but not during my chairmanship.
Right.
That was begun before that. And so we had that, and then we also had an MA program, which we very consciously tried to keep going. Some people wanted to start a PhD program, but I never could see any point in it. I mean, at least at that time, it seemed to me to be plenty of good schools, far better equipped to teach, to have a PhD program than we were.
Mm-hmm.
And I could say the same thing for some of the other departments, but maybe I was wrong. I do know that microbiology had a very good program, very good PhD program, and two or three other departments did too. History has a nice one, good one, but it was just developing, I think, when I was here.
Mm-hmm. So during your 17 years, which as you've pointed out is one of the longer stints as a chairperson.
Well, I guess they got so sick of me they decided to put it on a 3-year basis.
So is that one of your legacies?
That's one of my legacies. That's what I left the department.
What else would you say you left the department in that amount of time?
Well,
that you might consider significant, if not historical?
I have no idea, really. in my opinion, I did my best to keep the department going and developing and getting people to teach what they were competent to teach. And that was going against the grain sometimes, because that involved teaching all kinds of, several different kinds of weird courses in popular literature and this and that and the other thing. But I think that all of that was, if it's taught by a good man and in a good way, why, it tends to be a good course usually. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I try to get people to do and let them do. And I suppose that, I don't know, I don't see any, I don't think I had any legacy. I don't feel that I had one really. So after 17 years, it's too bad.
Well, you said one of the things you always strive to do was to keep the department going, keep people teaching what they wanted to teach. Certainly, it seems like the English department, as well as many of the departments in this school in general, has kept faculty here for a long time. Not that many people leave, which might not be what you'd expect from a rather geographically isolated university here at the time. And what about this department, the English department in general, do you think attracted people and kept them?
Well, I think we were a good department. I think we had good people, and we had a good program, an interesting program, and people enjoyed teaching. They enjoyed the students, and enjoyed other people here. And of course, the mountains keep people here, and the streams and that sort of thing. It's kind of interesting, though, a lot of people who just are not, don't take advantage, really, any serious advantage of the physical features of the country, still stay. So there must be something about it that mm-hmm. attracts them. Just what, it's hard to say, really. But you're right, a lot of good people in all the departments. And it's coming, they stay, and they like it, mm-hmm. even if they gripe a lot sometimes. And it's kind of hard. I don't know what keeps people here, really. It's not the best school in the world by a long shot, but it's good. And I think it's been a very good school for students.
How so?
I think they get as good an education here, at least as good an undergraduate education here as they get anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. And what makes that so?
Well, it's the teachers mm-hmm. and the various programs that the departments have. And I'm sure that some of the, as I say, some of the graduate departments, particularly at the PhD level, are quite good. But it's still not a research institution by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And people do good work, and that's about all I can say.
And so you've been retired for just over 20 years now?
Just about.
And you've just come out with your first book?
Yeah, and my last.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you say a few words about that and pursuing that after your academic career?
Well, it's kind of funny. I didn't do any writing much while I was chairman. I have a one-track mind, and all I could do was focus on what I was doing then. And some people, of course, can keep a lot of balls in the air, but I can't juggle very well. And so I just gave up any idea of writing when I became chairman. I may have done some few things, but not much. And so about the time I retired, I don't know, I started wondering what I was going to do after I retired. Everybody goes fishing and hunting. Well, you can only do that, so much of that, really. And I did enjoy it. I enjoyed hunting elk, and I just tracked them all over the place for years. I didn't take it up until I was 50 either. But it was a passion once I took it up. But anyhow, I started casting about, and I came across some letters that I had written home from the war which I called my war letters, and my mother had saved them, thinking I might want them someday, and I hadn't looked at them in 40 years. I knew that they were there in a nice little box, a round top to a little trunk, round trunk, top trunk. And so about the time I retired, I took them out and read them, and they seemed to me pretty good for what they were. So I got the idea of trying to put them into a book, just as a book of letters, which I was called—I think I called them the war—called it the War Letters. And I began peddling that, and I sent it to—I guess I sent it several places, but I sent it to Georgia in particular, in the University of Georgia Press, and the director there liked it very much. He read the letters and called me up and said they were fine, and so on, and he's going to give them to readers and so forth. He gave them to the first reader, and that reader apparently was a professor of English, maybe at the University of Georgia for all I know, but also a veteran of World War II, and he wrote about a 4-page critique, and some of the things he said I thought were nonsense, but he also said that the letters he thought were worth publishing, but not in their present form, that they needed what he called context, commentary, and analysis. Well, it took me 2 years to figure out what to do. And by the time I figured it out, Georgia was no longer interested. They had changed completely a lot. And so it sort of grew. And I had another book also that I was working on at the same time, and I sort of kept the two back and forth and working on them both, and gradually they just developed, and I remember I wrote a man in at Princeton who had written his memoir of World War II called Flights of Passage. I thought it was a great title. And what he did was simply describe how a Marine pilot is made. And that's it interested me, because I didn't know. I didn't know anything about how a pilot came to be. And he developed the book in terms of a series of tests that he went through in the process of becoming a pilot, ultimately. And the final test was flying a plane over to Okinawa, I guess. And so I wrote him and asked him about publishing. I wasn't getting too far with mine. And he said, well, it took him 11 years to get it published. Mm-hmm. And he was a professor at Princeton, and he had lots of ins that I didn't have. And he encouraged me with that. And so I just kept on going, and eventually it got picked up by Washington, the University of Washington Press.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out. Actually, now I can see that it needs marketing in the worst way, and they're not prepared to do it. And they rejected the other book, which is essentially one that would do best with a commercial press. Again, and the director there at Washington rejected it because he felt that well, in the first place, he felt he couldn't get it through the faculty committee. And in the second place, he felt that they just weren't equipped to market it. And I know they aren't, on the basis of what they've done with this book.
Mm-hmm.
And but at any rate, they were all very supportive. And that made me feel good, of course. And they thought it was a great book, and so on and so forth. And they just put it right through.
So between writing your first book, Hunting and Fishing, do you keep abreast of the University of Montana since you've been retired?
I haven't had anything to do with the University of Montana since I retired. I've had nothing to do with the department.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anybody in the department.
Mm-hmm.
Except I have kept in touch with one man, Jesse Beer, who came the year after I did. And while we're not close friends, we're, say, good friends, and have been all along. And when this book was published, he asked me if the department had done anything. well, I couldn't imagine the department would do anything in the first place because I didn't know anybody here as far as I knew to speak of. And he asked me that two or three times, and eventually the chairman of the department, his name Knight, Phil Knight or something like that, called me and asked me if I'd come to a departmental gathering for people who had written books or something like that. So I thought it was something that was in honor of everybody who'd written a book in the past year or something like that. Turned out it was in my honor, and Jesse had pushed the thing, I guess, and it was really quite nice to have the department have this shindig over in the honors building there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very pleased with that.
Good. Well, how about you finish us here with any other stories or remembrances you have of your time at the university that I haven't gotten you to talk about yet?
Oh, there's so many things I can't remember.
How about some you do remember?
It's hard for me to remember anything these days. I mean, to pick it out of the air.
Or just lasting impressions of your time here.
Well, I enjoyed very much my time here, and I've enjoyed my retirement immensely. Oh, I do remember right at the end there was a man named Leonard Robinson who had been he was married to Patricia Gerdica, one of our poets, and he was in his 80s, and I used to have lunch with him on a fairly regular basis, and when I was just after I was retired, he was talking about my writing career, and he was extremely supportive of my writing career. As he kept talking about me, crying out loud, "I'm not a writer, and never will be. I don't know what a writer is, really." But he kept talking about it, and he's a former editor and has done a lot of writing himself and so forth. And so he was very, very supportive, and he read a lot of the things I wrote. And so that gave me support and sort of pushed me. And then I came across some other letters that formed the basis for another book. And I've just really enjoyed it. That's all I've done. I go out in the mountains. I kept hunting for a long time. But I go out in the mountains, and pretty soon I noticed that I was just carrying my rifle around for the fun of it, basically. I wasn't shooting, I was passing up shots and all sorts of things. And I was just enjoying it. And I have an Alaskan camper, which is very much like a sheepherder's wagon, mm-hmm. which I call my sheepherder's wagon. It's something that you can pump up and stand up in and so on. And so I could just drive anywhere. I could drive a pickup, I could stop and camp. And so I camp up near the divide, or I'm down in the middle of sagebrush, but the thing, what I'm getting at is that eventually I discovered I just wasn't hunting anymore. I was just pretending to hunt, and so I was writing most of the time. I didn't do much reading in the camper. I just wrote, and sort of I probably drank too much, leaned out the window. And I still smoked cigars at that point. I gave up smoking cigarettes 35 or more than that now, years ago. And but I puffed on cigars. I didn't inhale them. Blew the smoke out the window. And it was a great life. And spent a lot of time. I could spend 2 weeks, 3 weeks out in the mountains all by myself. I was always by myself, virtually always, and I just enjoyed it very, very much. For a while, I did get elk every year, and I would get deer, and I liked to hunt Rocky Mountain sheep. I got several ewes, and getting a ram permit is just virtually impossible, but I did get one finally, and I got almost a full curl ram. The year after I retired, but I gradually gave that up. I remember one time I was hunting. I was up way up in something called Wagner's Basin over in the Sun River, And I shot a U. I, as I say, it's impossible to get a, very difficult to get a RAM permit because so many people apply for them. But it's easy to get a U permit, U only. Mm-hmm. And so I got way up in there and I shot a U and it was climbing way up, but I only wounded it. Poor thing was sort of struggling, trying to get up, but I must have broken his back or something like that. So I was coming and trying to climb up to it and get to it where I could shoot it and put it out of its misery. And I discovered that there was a little lamb with it. And a lamb came over, nuzzled its mother's head, lay down by it. And I had to go up there and scare the ram off and shoot its mother while it stood off there watching. And that was just a terrible experience for me. And that's when I really gave up hunting. Mm-hmm. And I did have a moose permit too. They're hard to get, but I finally got one after the year after I retired, I think. And I would remember I was out up the first day. It was a beautiful day out in the middle of a clear cut somewhere way up in the mountains somewhere. And two moose came up, a cow followed by a calf. A big calf, and I've glassed it very carefully, and it had two, it was a spikes what it was, and I glassed it, making sure it's what it was, and then I started putting my scope on it, and for some reason I put it down and then watch it, and it was having so much fun. It was a beautiful sunny morning, and it was gambling all around its mother and so forth, that I couldn't shoot the darn thing. So I just let it go.
Likely a wise decision.
It was. And for the irony of it was, I knew moose were up there. I knew where they were. And I went after them all the rest of that fall, and I tracked, I would follow the track through the snow and come up on a cow munching away on a bush. And I never did get a moose. So eventually I just sort of didn't hunt, I just pretended to hunt until the last and just enjoyed writing is what I did. When I published
the book. So you did have a writing career after all.
I guess I did. I wrote a lot of articles at the same time, and I wrote stories and so on, and I published a couple of them. And I have a very good story about that ram, I mean about that ewe, about yeah, and the lamb. But it hasn't gone anywhere. And but I've really enjoyed it, and I guess I have had a writing career after all. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like
I've written two books, published one, and published some articles, and so it's been a very good life in a way.
Well, thanks
and
for
all
sharing.
And all in all, the whole thing has been interesting. In other words, it's the teaching career was very good. And I enjoyed my administrative work. People say they don't enjoy it, but they do, I think. And I certainly did, and I make no bones about it. And not because of gave me power or anything, I just enjoyed making it easy for other people to work, is the way I looked at it. And my career afterwards has been very satisfactory. So all in all, I've enjoyed it, I guess.
It's kept you here in Missoula.
And it's kept me here in Missoula.
Good.
And I have three children over in Seattle, one of them in the opera over there. I just went over to see her last weekend, and she was great, naturally. But she's a good singer. And that was a good experience, too. And then two of them are doing quite well over there, the two of the boys, and my other son is, my oldest son's an associate professor at the University of Iowa. He writes plays. He had a play off Broadway and put on by one of the theaters there. We went to see it. He had the audacity to call it Oedipus. There are only two other, one was Sophocles, and I think Seneca, I think, had one, and I can't remember his name, but a French writer, Time of Molière, wrote one called Oedipus net, and my son comes along, right?
Well, he's in good company.
Yeah, he is.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time here. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure. I don't know whether I've really said anything much. I don't remember too much about the institution as such.
You know, it's not our job to decide be the arbitrators of what's going to be history for somebody else. It's just to put it down.
Well, I'm not sure it's history, anything I have to say.